Lady Jane, so it felt a little familiar. Then the tight-fitting suede pants, and finally the boots. Once fully dressed, I looked in the mirror. Even without the mask, I knew what it must have felt like for Douglas Fairbanks or Errol Flynn trying on their costumes for the first time on any one of their classic pirate movies. A knock at the door took me out of my reverie. "Are you decent?" came Phyllis's voice from behind it. "Yes." She opened the door, looked at me, and said, "Ah, that's not bad at all." She stopped to ponder. "But there's something missing." She then called over her assistant and asked her to go and fetch some black satin. When the assistant returned with the material, Phyllis tied one piece around my head and another around my waist, like a sash. "There," she said, "that's better." She then had me try on some temporary masks that she had designed, which were in fact not unlike the one worn by Fairbanks in Zorro. But none of them fit properly. Phyllis explained that since I would be wearing it throughout much of the film, not only did it have to fit perfectly, but most of all, it had to be comfortable, and that the only way to do that was to take a plaster mold of my head. This is a fairly standard procedure on movie productions that involve action or special effects or superheroes that wear masks, although I hadn't experienced it before. A seamstress then appeared and began to pin the pants so that they would be even more skin tight. I asked Phyllis whether I'd be able to put them on without difficulty once they had been sewn. She replied that she would prefer to sew them on each day, but that wouldn't be practical, given that I would be doing a lot of stunts in them. And, being suede, they would start to give a little anyway with time, she explained. I joked about knowing how Jim Morrison must have felt wearing his signature skin-tight leather pants. I then tried on an outfit made mostly of burlap and thick cotton, which would be Wesley's clothes as the infamous farm boy. Phyllis told me she had been inspired by paintings by N.C. Wyeth and Bruegel, and they felt very authentic to me, but she wasn't entirely happy. "No, let's come back to these. You need a hood of some kind." She said she needed a little more time to figure that out, and told me we would have more fittings soon. After a few Polaroid photographs were taken to show Rob, I changed back into my boring old jeans and t-shirt, thanked Phyllis, her assistant, and the seamstress, and headed home. The man in black was starting to take shape. The next day, I got another call from the production office and was given instructions about where to get a mold taken of my face. I had to travel to Shepperton Studios, where our production offices were set up, and visit the folks in the special effects, known as FX, department. Shepperton is located in the county of Surrey, about half an hour or so outside of London, and is generally regarded as one of the great European film studios. From a historical perspective, it's the sort of place that has an almost reverential appeal to most people in the business. Among the movies that have been filmed there are Lawrence of Arabia, Doctor Strangelove, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Elephant Man, Star Wars, Alien, and Gandhi, to name but a few. Having worked as a production assistant in my teens, I knew my way around film lots a little bit, but to be here at the famed Shepperton Studios, as the lead in a major Hollywood movie, was a different experience altogether. Map in hand, I walked to one of the shops assigned to our FX department on the lot and met with Nick Alder, our special effects supervisor. Nick had a great body of work behind him, having already worked on Alien. Yes, that was his nasty creature escaping from John Hurt's chest. The Empire Strikes Back? For you Jedis, there is a strong Star Wars connection to The Princess Bride, which I will get to later on. Conan the Barbarian, and The Jewel of the Nile. Nick, a very affable fellow, introduced me to his team, one of whom was already in the process of working on an unfinished animatronic rodent of unusual size, R.O.U.S., the one that would end up biting me during our fight in the fire swamp. It was made of white foam rubber and had no hair, which made it even more grotesque-looking. You could see all the wires and pulleys attached to the electronic servos that allowed the puppeteer to move the mouth. Even at this stage, it looked very effective, and they were proud to show it off to me. As I stared at the giant rat with its dead eyes, I wondered if Bill Goldman had ever experienced the same giant rats I had encountered while living in Manhattan, the ones the size of cats that make you freeze in your tracks. The kind that are not afraid of human beings and carry themselves with that swagger and give you that look that seems to imply, yeah, what are you going to do about it? Nick explained that while the procedure of covering my face with wet plaster of Paris was relatively painless, it could be very tedious, as I would be spending a long time, perhaps an hour, sitting in a chair with my face covered in said plaster. He asked if I was claustrophobic, which was kind of unnerving in and of itself, to which I replied, no, not really, not having any idea just how claustrophobic this whole process would be. He then said, we're going to be covering your whole head, but we will provide you with a couple of straws to put up your nose so you can breathe. Thank God for that. He continued, if at any time you feel uncomfortable, can't breathe, or if you're having some kind of panic attack, just make a slashing sign with your hand across your throat and we will begin taking off the plaster. Okay, I said, wondering just how many actors had had panic attacks before me. Just so you know, Nick went on, if we do that, we will have to repeat the process all over again to get it done. I replied that I understood. Great, said Nick. Let's get started, shall we? He and his colleagues then proceeded to completely cover my head with Vaseline and then plaster of Paris, and provided me with the aforementioned straws to put up my nostrils for breathing. Claustrophobic would be an understatement, folks. It felt like having your head encased in a suffocating, heavy, oversized pumpkin helmet made of clay. After an hour or so, they were done, and the plaster eventually dried. It was then cracked neatly open and removed from my head, and the resulting product was used as a mold. I was meant to look like a pirate, and not just any pirate, but the Dread Pirate Roberts, loosely based on the notorious privateer Bartholomew Roberts, the Scourge of the Seven Seas. His identity was supposed to be a secret, and while a leap of faith would be required to presume that the other characters in the film, most notably Buttercup, would not immediately spot the resemblance between Wesley and the Man in Black, the audience was free to make the connection, which of course they did. Still, it had to look right. Despite going to great lengths to create dozens of perfect masks, the makeup department still wound up having to use dark makeup around my eyes in some scenes to create a seamless transition between mask and skin, much like what I understand they do with all the folks who play Batman. After I cleaned my face, I was met by a production assistant who told me that Rob wanted to see me in his office. We headed over to the production office, following signs reading Buttercup Films Limited, and went upstairs. As I walked in, Rob got to his feet from behind his desk and greeted me with that warm smile of his. Hey, Carrie, how you doing? A usual Rob sing-songy refrain. Great, thanks. Good to see you. He gave me a bear hug. It should be noted that all hugs from Rob are bear hugs. So, how did the face mold go? Weird, I responded. I know, right? He laughed. Did they stick the straws up your nose? Yes, and I almost threw up through them. Rob chuckled. Come on, I want to show you around. We have a great crew, he said, and I want you to meet them. It was extremely thoughtful of Rob to extend the invitation. Not many directors do that with their actors during pre-production, but Rob was different. I would learn later that he had handpicked nearly every member.
Chris Sarandon.
The crew was fantastic. The crews I've worked with in England, generally speaking, are just great fun. A lot of them are working-class guys, men and women. A lot of them EastEnders, and they're just loose. They're fabulous.
I ended up meeting quite a lot of them that day, from the bookkeepers to the folks in the props department, and almost everyone in between. Every time we ran into someone, Rob would stop and introduce us, and, with unfailing enthusiasm, say to them, "And this is Carrie. He's playing Wesley." In the art department, I met our production designer, Norman Garwood, with whom I would end up working on two more movies. Norman is an ebullient, sweet guy and obviously very talented. He had worked on two magnificent Terry Gilliam movies, Time Bandits and Brazil, and on The Missionary, all of them containing one of my favorite comedians, Michael Palin. More about him later. Clearly, Norman was a Monty Python favorite, which made him perfect for our production in my book, being a Python fan myself. Every inch of the walls was covered in magnificent drawings and paintings of all the sets, from Miracle Max's cabin to Buttercup's suite in Florin Castle, and from Fred Savage's bedroom to the Pit of Despair, They were simply magical. One could really see the mythology of the film starting to take shape. As I expressed my excitement at the visual imagery surrounding me, Norman suggested to Rob that he take me for a tour of the sets they were already starting to build.
"Oh yeah, you gotta see 'em," Rob said enthusiastically. "They're really something."
Rob took me back outside, and we walked over to H stage, where carpenters, plasterers, and painters were deep into the process of constructing the set for the fire swamp, which was starting to get filled with fake trees, creepers, vines, and giant mushrooms. The detail was extraordinary. I remember turning to Rob and saying, "Wow, it's like the Wizard of Oz."
"Pretty cool, huh?" he replied.
He then took me over to C stage, and as we walked onto the set, I stood and marveled at the sight of the massive clifftop where the famous duel between Wesley and Inigo Montoya would take place. Standing on that soundstage, with its cloudy blue sky backdrop, I felt a palpable sense of, not relief, but more like joy. I didn't doubt that Rob could pull this off. I just hadn't envisioned how he would do it. Now it was becoming real. I could tell this was clearly the most expensive production either of us had ever been involved with, and a lot of its success was riding on whoever was playing Buttercup and that fellow playing Wesley. Gulp. As we walked back to the production offices, I asked Rob about the rest of the cast. He mentioned that he'd already recruited his friends Billy Crystal and Chris Guest, which was very cool, and that Mandy Patinkin would play Inigo Montoya, the avenging Spaniard. I didn't recall Mandy's body of work at that point, but I assumed, given Rob's meticulous casting, that he would be a perfect choice. He then ran through a stellar lineup of talent that they were apparently in negotiations with, including Wally Shawn to play Vincini. "Oh, I love him," I said. "How great is my dinner with Andre?"
"Amazing," Rob said. "And I think we also got Chris Sarandon for Humperdinck and Carol Kane for Miracle Max's Wife."
"No way," I responded incredulously.
"How about that for casting?"
He was almost as excited as I was.
Chris Sarandon.
My ex-wife, Susan Sarandon, had done a movie with Robert Redford, and Redford at the time owned the film rights to the book. He wanted to make the movie, and he gave her a copy of it to read. I read it as well, and I just flipped over it. There was such a wonderful combination of adventure, satire, parody, and it was a great romance. It was having fun with the different genres, and I just thought, this is amazing. I hope this movie gets made. But of course, years went by, and nothing happened. So, jump cut to many years later, and suddenly I get a call from one of my agents saying, "Rob Reiner and Bill Goldman want you to read for The Princess Bride for the role of Prince Humperdinck." And I went, "Oh my God, this is a dream come true. I love this book."
Carol Kane.
I was beyond lucky to be a part of this. I got a call from Rob about being in it and to play Billy's wife. At the time I was doing a play in Williamstown, I don't think I even thought about it much. I just said yes. The idea of being Billy's wife in a big old fairy tale just sort of, it's not something to think about. You just do it. Then I read the screenplay, and I loved it. And then Billy and I got together in my apartment later in L.A., and we kind of built ourselves a life, a little backstory for our characters.
This was turning out to be a much bigger production than I had initially imagined.
"And we're so lucky. We also found our Buttercup," Rob added. "It took a while, but we found her."
I became intrigued by Rob's fascination with his discovery of the perfect Buttercup. "How'd you find her?" I asked.
"Turns out the casting director had a picture on the wall the whole time. But for some reason, we never called her in because we were so busy looking for Brits."
"Who is she?" I asked curiously.
"Her name is Robin Wright. You ever heard of her?"
I had not, and admitted as much. Rob nodded.
"She's on this TV show, Santa Barbara. It's a daytime soap. But don't let that fool you. She's amazing. She came in and read for us and just blew us away," Rob went on. "Wait till you meet her. Oh my God, you're gonna love her."
With that, we continued walking down the hall. And just as we turned a corner, less than a minute later, there she was, walking up the stairs.
Rob Reiner.
I saw hundreds of girls, but they had to be, as described in the script, the most beautiful girl in all the land. And she had to have an English accent. And Robin, even though she's American, has an English stepfather, so she came by that very naturally. And she was stunningly beautiful and the right age. She was literally the only one I saw who could play the role.
William Goldman. I went out to California because we were trying to find Buttercup. She had to be the most beautiful girl in the world. And all these beautiful girls came in and they were gorgeous, but they weren't Buttercup. Finally, Rob called and said, "I think I found her." And then Robin came in the room and we talked for a minute, and I immediately called Rob and said, "Grab her." Because she was, as you know, just unbelievable. And she still is. Andy Scheinman.
Robin was perfect. But you know what? They made her do an extra year on Santa Barbara in exchange for giving her time off to do the movie, which I thought was kind of rotten. But she didn't complain. Robin was, well, I mean, she's such a beautiful girl, and the part called for that. But there was a sweetness, too. There are a lot of beautiful women, a lot of beautiful actresses, but there aren't a lot of beautiful women who are also really funny. Not that she has to be hysterically funny to play Buttercup, but she has to be able to understand what's funny about the script and the role, and have a great sense of humor.
"Hey, there she is," Rob called out to her. "Hiya, Robin. I want you to meet someone."
She was tall and willowy, with long blonde hair and large blue expressive eyes. In a word, gorgeous. She was also very young, as I'd soon discover, barely 20, and I felt a small sense of relief that I wouldn't be the youngest person on the movie, not counting Fred Savage. I'll never forget the first time Rob introduced us. "Carrie," he said, "this is Robin. She's playing Buttercup, the girl you're going to fall in love with." A huge smile formed on her face as she turned to him and said, "Oh, Rob," as if to say, "please." And then she extended her hand to shake mine. "Hi," she said in a very sweet tone. What I said besides "hi" back, I cannot recall. I probably didn't say a great deal, since I felt like I had been poleaxed. I remember Goldman's description of Buttercup in the book. She was the most beautiful woman in 100 years. She didn't seem to care. And that was exactly true as far as Robin was concerned. It was as if I were looking at a young Grace Kelly. She was that beautiful. My awkwardness must have been obvious, because Rob gave me a little nudge to the ribs and a grin that seemed to say, "Huh? Am I right or what?" I do remember Robin mimicking a perfect English accent, something she does remarkably well, and then totally disarming me with a giggle that mushroomed into the most wonderful laugh. I remember thinking to myself, wow, how many women are that beautiful and that funny as well? I mean, it figures that Rob would find someone talented to play Buttercup, but to have that combination of beauty and comic sensibility, that's a rare and wonderful thing.
Robin Wright.
My theory is that they were so completely tired of meeting actresses in Hollywood. I think I was probably the 500th girl that they read. And at that point, they were like, just cast her, make her the princess, anything. Let's just be done with this process. I think it was my lucky fate. They were exhausted.
It turns out that Robin had stopped by the studio for her own last-minute costume fittings. I think we ended the conversation with her saying she was really looking forward to working with me, and me stammering something hopeless in return, like, "me too." To use a phrase that would be perfectly appropriate in the fairy tale realm of The Princess Bride, I was smitten. Within a few minutes, we had gone our separate ways. Robin off to her fitting, and I back to the production office to sign some paperwork and pick up a copy of the schedule. But to be honest, I couldn't concentrate on much of anything after that first encounter with Robin. She was the perfect Buttercup in my mind's eye. I couldn't wait to get started. Chapter 3. The Table Read and Meeting Fezzik. A few days later, everyone in the cast gathered for our first table read in the banquet room of the Dorchester Hotel, one of London's oldest and most stylish five-star inns, situated in the elegant Mayfair district, where Rob, Andy, and Bill were staying. As I entered the room, I looked around and noticed that most of the cast was already there, looking very relaxed. The room was also fully stocked with soft drinks and snacks laid out on silver platters, including the hotel's famous watercress and egg sandwiches. At the center of the room was a large oak table with some 20 chairs around it. On the table were a number of scripts. A couple dozen more chairs ringed the perimeter, seating for the heads of various departments. I saw Rob and Andy talking to a man whom I immediately recognized as Bill Goldman and made a beeline for them. "Hey, Carrie," said Rob, giving me another bear hug. "Have you met Bill yet?" "No," I stammered. "Hi." There he was, standing right in front of me, the legendary William Goldman, a man whose work had enthralled me as a kid. He was tall and thin and had wisps of gray hair. He also had a warm smile and an easy demeanor about him.
"Nice to meet you," he
said, shaking my perspiring hand. As I began to tell him how much I enjoyed the script and the book, dialogue I'm sure Goldman was well used to by this point in his career, the topic came around to Fezzik.
"William Goldman. I knew I had a giant in the story, and then I was watching television once, years before I ever wrote the screenplay, and I thought, Andre could play the giant. Then I went to Madison Square Garden, and I saw him and fell in love with him like everybody did, and he was wonderful for us." Andy Scheinman.
Finding Andre was interesting. You know, there's a scene where Wesley rides on Fezzik's back while they're wrestling, right? Well, I ended up riding on the backs of so many gigantic people trying to find this guy, because when we'd meet and ask them to read, they all said, "I could do it better if you were on my back for this scene." There was the guy who won the World's Strongest Man contest, and I'm riding around on this guy's back while he's trying to say his lines. We met a couple of other guys, including Richard Kiel, who had played Jaws in the James Bond movies, The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, but none of them were even close.
"So who's playing him?" I asked. "Oh man, we got the perfect guy," Rob said excitedly. "Remember the wrestler I told you about in Berlin? His name is Andre the Giant."
"His last name is really the Giant?"
"You've never heard of him?"
Bill Goldman asked, cracking a smile.
"I think I'd remember that name."
"Oh, he's terrific. He's a world-famous wrestler,"
Bill replied. Turns out he was a self-described lunatic fan of Andre's.
"Did you ever see that episode of The $6 Million Man where he meets Bigfoot?" Rob asked me.
"I think so," I said, as it started to dawn on me. I'm not sure.
"Anyway, that's him, the Bigfoot guy," exclaimed Rob.
"And it was perfect casting, as his feet really are big," Andy chimed in with a hilarious understatement.
"So he's a real giant then?" I asked.
"He's literally the biggest guy on the planet, and you get to fight him. How about that?"
Rob said with a huge laugh.
The biggest guy on the planet? I tried to conjure up an image in my head.
Rob Reiner.
"Bill Goldman was the one who said, 'You should look at Andre the Giant.' We all knew Andre because we'd seen him wrestling, but I had no idea if he could act or not. We met him at a hotel in Paris, and when we walked in, the manager said, 'There's a man waiting for you at the bar.' So we walked into the bar, and it was literally like Fezzik was described in the book. It was like a landmass sitting on a bar stool. He came up to our hotel room to read. We had a three-page scene for him to audition with, and I didn't understand a word he said. Also, he had never been in one place for more than 2 weeks. He was always traveling all over the world. So I said, 'You know, this is 15 weeks, right, Andre? You'll be in town for 15 weeks. And he says, "I'd do it, boss." And then he says, "You want me to play these three pages for 15 weeks? He thought that this was his whole part. So I said, no, you're all throughout the film. There's a lot of scenes. And again, he says, "I'd do it, boss." So he leaves, and he was a really sweet guy, but I turned to Andy and I said, "Oh my God, I don't know if he can do this or not, but he was perfect for the part. I mean, he looked exactly right."
At that very moment, the door to the ornate room opened, and in walked the giant himself, Andre.
It was like a scene from an old Western, where the guy enters the saloon and everyone stops what they're doing, including the piano player. The first thing I remember about him, besides his immense height, of course, was his beautiful, sweet, beaming smile. It was a giant smile, and the reason for this was because his teeth were regular size, so you could see all of them as he opened his mouth. He had to bow down low as he came through the doorway, so he wouldn't crack his head on the doorframe, obviously something he had become accustomed to over the years. I remember Rob introducing us and watching my fingers disappear as we shook hands, completely engulfed by a palm bigger than a catcher's mitt. If you want to get a sense of just how big they were, Google Andre the Giant and beer can, and you'll understand what I'm talking about. According to his official website, his shoe size was 24, and his wrist was nearly a foot in circumference. Standing next to him, I only came up to his belly button. In retrospect, Andre seemed to have been born to play the role. Like Rob said, it's not like you put out a casting call for a giant and get a ton of callbacks. He was a real giant, standing 7'4" tall and weighing 540 pounds. According to Rob, Andre had first expressed trepidation about being in the film. Being French, his real name is André René Roussimoff, he was apparently highly insecure about his ability to speak English fluently. Rob eased his concerns by sending him an audio-taped version of the scene he wanted him to look at involving Fezzik, so André could listen to it and study it, and then, if he was so inclined, read for the part, which he did for Rob and Andy when they flew to Paris after meeting with me in Berlin. When the reading was over, Rob turned to him and said, "That was great, André. You got it, buddy."
"Thanks, boss," came the reply.
It should be noted that despite his gargantuan size, André took to calling everyone boss as a way of disarming them in a very charming way. Eventually, the whole script was put on tape for him so that he could understand and memorize his role. And he did a great job with it, despite English not being his first language and his not being in the best of health. He was apparently due for an operation on his back.
Rob Reiner.
"So what I did was put down on tape his entire part. I acted it out for him, and he studied it over and over until he got it. I mean, we never had to even loop him. So Andre was the third piece. If I don't get any one of them, I can't make the movie."
Andy Scheinman.
"So Rob and I ended up recording all of Andre's scenes on tape. Rob did Andre, and I did whoever else was in the scene. And Andre would walk around in headphones with that tape playing all the time, listening, figuring it out. And it worked. He was great."
That first table read was an extraordinary experience. There seemed to be so many gifted people in one room. On more than one occasion, I had to choke back nerves provoked by working with such an extraordinary group of talented people. I looked at Chris Sarandon and thought, this is the guy who was nominated for an Academy Award for his portrayal of Leon, his very first film role in one of my favorite Sidney Lumet movies, Dog Day Afternoon.
Chris Sarandon.
The audition went something like this. I walk in the door, and Rob and Bill Goldman are both very lovely, very friendly. And I said, "I'm sorry, I just picked up the newspaper and I can't hold myself back. The Knicks drafted Kenny Sky Walker." And Bill Goldman and I then proceeded to talk about the Knicks draft choice for like the next 10 or 15 minutes, both of us being totally pissed off. Well, by the end of the conversation, I felt completely comfortable because it was just a couple of New York guys talking about basketball. And then Rob said to me, very tactfully, "Would you mind reading the scene?" So I read. And it was the scene in which Humperdinck asks Buttercup if she would consider him as an alternative to suicide. I think they chose that scene because it's very funny, but I read it totally straight. And Rob just cracked up. Because, well, first of all, he's the greatest audience in the world, but also because it was the tone that he was looking for. Comedy is serious stuff. And the next thing I knew, I was on a plane to England to make the movie.
I looked over and saw Wally Shawn, and I instantly thought not only of his remarkable performance and wonderful writing in My Dinner with Andre, but his roles in All That Jazz and Manhattan. And there was Mandy,
whom I now recognize from Milos Forman's Ragtime, standing in the corner chatting with Chris Guest. Both of them serious veterans of the business. It was crazy. Everyone seemed to have a more prestigious resume than I did. Even Fred Savage had already managed to cram in an incredible amount of television work by the tender age of 10. This was not your ordinary Hadassah group, as Goldman once famously put it. Even though I did my best to hide it, I began to develop a slight inferiority complex.
Rob Reiner.
I did sense that Mandy was very nervous about doing the movie, and I had to talk him off the ledge a couple of times. But I never had to do that with Carrie. He was, you know, very stiff upper lip or whatever those Brits do. He carried it off.
There were other surprises that day, like the unexpected presence of the screenwriter Buck Henry, wearing his trademark baseball cap and glasses. He had nothing to do with The Princess Bride, but happened to be in London on other business and was staying in the hotel. Even though I had never met him, I obviously knew his work. Here was a guy whose acting and writing career had already spanned across 3 decades, from creating Get Smart in the mid-1960s with Mel Brooks, to writing screenplays for The Graduate, Catch-22, and Heaven Can Wait, among many others. He was a friend of Rob's and a repeat host of Saturday Night Live. I guess everyone felt that if Buck wanted to sit in on the reading, why the heck not? Clearly he wasn't there to comment on the screenplay. Nobody punches up Bill Goldman. I suppose the thought was that if we could make Buck Henry laugh, chuckle, or even smile during the read, then maybe we were in good shape. Ironically, given that our characters were at the center of the story, Robin and I were the relative newcomers in the group. Even Andre was a far more experienced performer than we were. Besides appearing on The $6 Million Man, he had been on a number of TV shows, including BJ and the Bear, The Fall Guy, and The Greatest American Hero, and made an uncredited appearance as a favor to his friend Arnold Schwarzenegger in Conan the Destroyer. It could also be said that he was a showman in every sense of the word. This was a guy, after all, who put on a leotard just about every night of his life and staged a show for thousands of fans. Up to that point, I had only made British films, and table readings were not really fashionable in the UK back then. A table reading basically serves a dual purpose. The first is to give everyone a sense of the rhythm of the script. There is a difference between reading the words by yourself and hearing them recited aloud by all the actors playing the roles. And the second, to allow everyone to meet one another in a relaxed, fun atmosphere. Basically, it's a play day, at the end of which, if it's successful, you can begin to get a sense of the movie in your mind's eye. After a suitable amount of time had passed, Rob signaled to our production manager, David Barron, for the proceedings to begin. "Everyone please take a seat," David announced. We all took our assigned seats around the table, a little placard stating our name in front of each of us. Rob was seated at the head of the table. To his left was Andy, and to his right, Bill Goldman.
"Let's go round the table and introduce ourselves," Rob announced. "I'm Rob Reiner, and I'm the director. Thank you all for being here. I just wanted to say how thrilled and excited I am to be making this movie. I know we're going to have a lot of fun."
He paused, then gestured to his left and said,
"And this is Andy Scheinman, our producer, who will also be directing Second Unit. And because Billy and Carol aren't here yet, I will be reading Miracle Max, and Andy will be reading Valerie."
Andy then lifted his hand and said, "Hi, I'm Valerie." That got a laugh. As I would find out later, it is customary at table reads for each person around the table to introduce themselves, followed by the character they are playing. I sat next to Robin, number 4 or 5 on the list of introductions. I remember feeling my hands start to sweat just thinking about it. I folded them in my lap so that no one would notice.
Chris Sarandon.
Carrie and Robin were just perfection. They were the perfect physical casting for these two characters. And my recollection of Carrie was that I thought this guy, he's a leading man, but he can do so much more. He does dialects. He tells great stories. He's a very talented guy. And I think we were all a little smitten with Robin because she was so lovely. And there's a sense of mystery about Robin that I think she just has naturally. And so I never for a moment thought, oh boy, we're in for it with these two newcomers. I just felt like we all bonded. Plus, it's so much easier when you're all together, and you become friends on location, because then you trust each other. You know each other really well. You know what you can get away with, and what's apropos. You learn to get along.
When the appropriate time came, and my heart rate was at an all-time high, I blurted out, "Hi, I'm Cary Elwes, and I'm playing Wesley." I had no idea whether this reading was a test. Suppose they heard my rendition of this character and decided to replace me. "Calm, Cary. Try to remain calm," I kept telling myself. The only thing that even began to bring my pulse rate down was watching Bill. If there was one person at the table who appeared to be more nervous than me, it had to have been him. As I would soon discover, his colossal talent notwithstanding, Goldman was a rather famously anxious writer. As I looked over at him, he seemed to be withdrawing into himself, trying to become smaller. When it came his turn to introduce himself, he offered a brief background about how he came to write the book and how the book became a screenplay. How it had been a true labor of love and a storybook gift to his daughters. How for years he had wondered whether it would ever be adapted to the screen, even whether it could be. He then grew even quieter.
"Please understand that this is a very personal project," Bill said,
his voice fading almost to a whisper.
"Normally I don't care much for any of my work, but this one is different. It's my favorite thing I've ever written in my life. So if I appear a little nervous, that's the reason."
He then thanked Rob and all of us for being there and assured us that the project was in good hands. On some deep and profound level, I think the prospect of the Princess Bride coming to life must have terrified him. After all, this was clearly the most cherished accomplishment of his artistic life, and I don't think many people in the room knew that it was that personal to him until he mentioned it. In hindsight, it made sense that he formed a very close bond with Rob. He didn't want just anyone making the movie. He really wanted it to be done right. I can only imagine what it must have been like for him, sitting there quietly and listening to other people read the lines he had so meticulously written. To watch the actors bring his words and characters to life and hope and pray to God that it worked. It wasn't just that he wanted the film to be successful. I think he was actually fearful it might fail. I'm sure he was thinking, what if no one laughs at the jokes? Worse yet, what if they laugh in places where they're not supposed to? There are so many ways it could all go wrong. Then, after the last actor announced themselves, Rob started to read from the script. "The Princess Bride by William Goldman. Fade in on a video game on a computer screen." I looked over at Goldman. From that point on, he just sat quietly, taking it all in, no doubt dissecting every word uttered as he silently turned the pages. Every so often, he'd pick up his pencil and scribble something in the margin. I noticed he did it a couple of times while I was reading. Perhaps he was just making a note on the dialogue. I certainly hoped that was the reason. Rob did this as well, but mostly he just laughed a lot. I should take a moment, before continuing, to explain to those of you who have not seen the movie or read the book what this extraordinary tale of the Princess Bride is about. For those of you who have at least a passing acquaintance with the story, or maybe even know it by heart, you may skip ahead if you wish. But for those who haven't, I hereby offer some background. If you don't want a spoiler alert, then perhaps you should watch the movie first before continuing, or skip this section. So, with sincere apologies to Mr. Goldman, let's begin. In the movie version of The Princess Bride, the fairy tale is told within the framework of an elderly grandfather reading a book to his sick grandson. The book the grandfather is reading is entitled The Princess Bride, and the grandfather promises him it is filled with action and adventure. But the boy, recoiling at the first kissing part, thinks he has been hoodwinked into listening to a love story. Eventually, he becomes enthralled by the tale and can't wait to find out what happens to Wesley and his beloved Buttercup. Wesley's first words to her are, "As you wish," which really means, "I love you." And he devotes the entire film, and several years of his life, to the pursuit of making good on that promise. Fearing that a simple farm boy will never be able to provide adequately for his love, Wesley sets off in search of his fortune, intending to return one day and wed Buttercup. Alas, his plans are derailed when his ship is attacked by the dread pirate Roberts, who, as legend has it, never takes prisoners alive. Several years pass, and Buttercup, although still in love and mourning for Wesley, agrees to marry Prince Humperdinck, the rich and duplicitous heir to the throne of Florin. And here the story becomes thick with plot twists, double crosses and triple crosses that make Goldman's Byzantine Marathon Man seem almost simplistic by comparison. Prior to the wedding, Buttercup is kidnapped by an unlikely trio of men: Spanish swordmaster Inigo Montoya, the Sicilian Vincini, and a giant named Fezzik. Buttercup does not realize that her captors have been hired by Humperdinck, who hopes to blame the kidnapping and the eventual killing of Buttercup on his rival country of Gilda, thereby instigating a war between the two. Humperdinck feigns love for Buttercup by setting off with several of his soldiers in pursuit of the captors. At the same time, a mysterious man in black also gives chase. Confusing? It gets better. The man in black pursues the kidnappers as they scale the cliffs of insanity. He bests Inigo Montoya in a duel, aka the greatest sword fight in modern times, but chooses only to knock him out rather than to kill him. Even more improbably, he emerges victorious in an epic display of hand-to-hand combat with Fezzik, and then outwits Vincini in a deadly battle of dizzying intellect, tricking the arrogant Sicilian into poisoning himself. All of this happens in the first half of the movie and sets the stage for the reunion of Wesley and Buttercup. You see, the man in black is actually Wesley, who was in fact taken prisoner by the dread pirate Roberts. When Roberts reached retirement age, Wesley, figuring that Buttercup had moved on with her life, took his place. This epic plot twist is revealed as Wesley tumbles down the world's longest, steepest hillside, having been shoved by an angry Buttercup. From that point on, The Princess Bride becomes more or less a chase film, a very funny, unusual chase film. Wesley and Buttercup endure the fire swamp, battling its mini fire volcanoes, quicksand, and a battle with ROUSs. They are, however, eventually captured by Humperdinck and the evil six-fingered Count Rugen, who, as it happens, was also responsible for the death of Inigo's father many years earlier, a death Inigo has vowed to revenge. Buttercup barters for Wesley's life by agreeing to marry Humperdinck, but the prince breaks his promise and, instead of freeing Wesley, turns him over to Rugen, who imprisons him in the pit of despair and apparently tortures him to death. By the way, this was the moment in the writing of the book when Bill Goldman told me later he actually broke down and cried. He was so sad about Wesley's death. He said he loved the character so much and knew it worked, but he was also concerned he couldn't figure out a way to bring him back. So he shelved the book for a while until he could come up with a solution. I say apparently tortures him to death because, of course, as any Princess Bride fan will tell you, Wesley is not really dead. Note, this was Bill's brilliant solution and what he calls one of the high points of his creative life. His supposedly lifeless body is taken to Miracle Max and his wife Valerie by his new allies, Fezzik and Inigo, who believe the man in black is just the man they need in order to successfully storm Humperdinck's castle and confront Count Rugen. Max explains to them that Wesley is only mostly dead. Wesley is revived, the castle wall is breached, and Inigo duels and slays Count Rugen, but not before uttering once again his character's most famous line.
"Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You kill my father. Prepare to die."
As Rugen pleads for his life and says he will give Inigo whatever he wants if only he will let the Count live, Inigo kills him with the line,
"I want my father back, you son of a bitch."
Meanwhile, Wesley, still suffering temporary partial paralysis, a side effect of the giant chocolate-covered miracle pill prescribed by Miracle Max, avoids a duel with Humperdinck and succeeds in tying him to a chair. While Humperdinck wallows in cowardice, Wesley and Buttercup leave the castle and ride off triumphantly with Fezzik and Inigo. There is a passing of the torch, or the black mask, as it were, as Inigo weighs an offer to become the new dread pirate Roberts. A glorious kiss between Buttercup and Wesley, and the presumption of a happily ever after ending. So that, in an egregiously truncated form, again, please forgive me, Bill, is the story of The Princess Bride, a story we would spend the better part of 4 months trying to put on film. Finally, we came to the end of the reading of the script, and the whole room burst into applause. I wasn't sure that applause was a common response following a reading, but it seemed appropriate under the circumstances. By any reasonable standard, the event felt like a success. It had been peppered with genuine laughter. Even Buck Henry had chuckled in all the right places. Buck didn't strike me as a real laugh-out-loud kind of guy. Reiner was beaming. Bill was clapping too, and there was a faint smile on his face. For the rest of us in that room, I think we all knew that we were part of something special. Did we think the movie would become an enduring pop culture phenomenon? Of course not. But did we feel involved in something truly unique? Definitely. For myself, I just felt enormously grateful to be there. To be involved in a project with so many gifted people, not to mention getting to be in a film written by the legendary William Goldman and directed by the remarkable Rob Reiner. Life is good, I thought.
Christopher Guest.
Having read dozens and dozens of scripts or more, I know there are only a handful of people that I can literally put in a class of great screenwriters. And Bill Goldman is certainly one of them. It's brilliant writing. The dialogue is brilliant. The descriptions are brilliant. It's funny on every level. And there are a lot of really well-drawn characters. From an actor's standpoint, you couldn't possibly ask for more. It's a dream to read a great script, and you're lucky if that happens once in your life. This was a rare thing where you trusted the words that you had to say.
Mandy Patinkin. You know, I was never a great movie connoisseur. I certainly saw Butch Cassidy in The Sundance Kid, but I didn't know who Bill Goldman was, really. I just read the script and thought, this is great. So I had no outside influences. I just knew I had read something wonderful. Knowing Goldman now, of course, I'd think, well, obviously it's going to be great.
Afterward, we made our way to a nearby restaurant where they had set up lunch outside on a back patio. I remember finding myself sitting next to Robin again. What quickly became apparent about her, besides her sense of humor, was how cool she was. She could hang with the guys. She told me about growing up in San Diego, how she had always wanted to be a dancer, and then done some modeling and kind of fell into acting. She'd been a leading player on Santa Barbara for a couple of years, and she had only one previous movie role, playing a homeless drug addict in Hollywood Vice Squad. I had not yet done any television, and remember being fascinated by what it was like for her working on a soap. She explained that she had to learn anywhere from 10 to 20 pages of dialogue a day, working with up to 3 cameras simultaneously, and with a different director for each episode. That it moved very fast, which forced her to think on her feet as an actor. I also remember her telling me how lucky she felt that the show let her out of her contract to do the movie, as normally they didn't do that. I asked her how she knew how to do a British accent so well. She then proceeded to tell me about her British stepfather, who had introduced her to Monty Python at an early age. An intelligent and beautiful young woman who loves Monty Python playing opposite me as Buttercup. Does it get much better than that? And looking around the table at the talent I was about to work with, I felt blessed to have been given this incredible opportunity. For most of us, the day ended relatively early. Most of us, except for Andre, that is, who, we discovered later, ended up spending the night at the hotel, even though he wasn't staying there. Andre, as I stated earlier, was not at his physical peak. He was, in fact, suffering. All those years of toting around so much weight had left him with this very painful condition, which had only been exacerbated in the ring. I remember him telling me his opponents rarely held back when jumping up and down on his back or smashing metal chairs on his head, thinking that since he was a giant, he could take it. I found out from his friends, much later on, that his classic one-piece black wrestling outfit was specifically designed to hide a back brace. Andre was due to have an operation after he wrapped the movie, but until then, the only medication he could take to deal with the pain was alcohol. Now, if you think Andre could eat, you should have seen him drink. It was legendary. Word had it that even before he developed the injury, he could drink 100 beers in one sitting. According to some estimates, his average daily consumption of alcohol was a case of beer, 3 bottles of wine, and a couple of bottles of brandy. But what I witnessed was something quite different. At mealtimes, besides the incredible amount of food he ate, I noticed that rather than using a regular glass, Andre drank from a beer pitcher, which looked a lot like a regular glass in his hands anyway. In reality, it was 40 ounces of alcohol, which he nicknamed the American. Usually some combination of hard and soft liquor and whatever else he felt like mixing it with that day. I should point out that not once did I notice any sign of the alcohol affecting him, which made sense given his size. So kids, don't try this at home or you'll most likely end up in the hospital.
Andy Scheinman.
One day he came to work and I said, "How you doing today, Andre?" He goes, "Oh, not too good, boss." I said, "What's the matter?" "Oh, I had a tough night last night. I drank 12 bottles of wine, 3 bottles of cognac." I said, "Oh my God, Andre, did you get sick?" He goes, "No, get a little tipsy, though." That was Andre.
Robin Wright.
I remember going to dinner with him for the first time, and he ordered, I believe, 5 entrees. And I thought, okay, that's normal for a man that size. And I realized later that that was just his appetizer. He was a bottomless pit when it came to food.
It turns out that same night after the read-through, Andre decided he would sample some of the finest vintage aperitifs and liqueurs from the cellars of the prestigious hotel, and ended up closing the bar. When it came to last call, he got up to leave, but never made it to the front door, instead passing out cold in the lobby. The night porter was called, who in turn summoned security, who in turn rang engineering. Manpower was apparently needed. Yet, despite their valiant efforts, there was simply no waking or even slightly budging what could only be described as an unconscious 500-pound Gulliver spread out on their very ornate carpet. A meeting was held, and the wise decision was made to leave him there. It was either that or call the police, but somehow I don't think management wanted the publicity. For safety purposes, both to protect him and any passers-by, they decided to place a small velvet rope barrier around Andre, who was by now snoring loudly enough to shake the lobby walls. The hope was that he would wake up on his own soon enough, but it was not to be as soon as they had hoped. The housekeepers, who arrived the next morning to vacuum, had no idea what to do with the massive sleeping giant blocking their path, and were literally terrified to touch him. Then, sometime around 10 a.m., Andre began to stir and eventually awoke to the sounds of vacuum cleaners and the horrified looks of staff and guests alike. He was unfazed by all this. He got to his feet, straightened his clothes and hair a little, and headed straight for the front door, his original objective. A cab was called by the startled doorman, but the driver took one look at Andre and refused to take him. Finally, a minivan was sent for, and Andre made it home safely. Needless to say, he is now part of the establishment's law.
Chapter 4, On Guard. I was not a particularly noteworthy athlete growing up. Like most other schoolboys in the UK, I played soccer, rugby, and cricket, but not well. The only sport I excelled in was long-distance running, and even though I generally tried to stay active physically, my interests from an early age focused more on the arts than athletics. So it was with some trepidation that I began to fully consider the requirements of the part I had been assigned to play. It wasn't just about having the right look, or even the proper sense of comic timing. There was a specific physicality to the role as well. And while I was young enough, fairly fit enough, and perhaps even foolish enough to think I could handle almost anything thrown my way, the reality of the situation was something quite different. I knew I could run through fire swamps, wrestle rodents of unusual size, and maybe even fight a giant. But when it came to sword fighting, I have to admit that I simply had no idea of the complexity of the preparation that would be required to perform it adequately. And to be honest, simply adequate was not going to cut it. Not for a scene that was described by Goldman himself in the screenplay as the greatest sword fight in modern times. Goldman had apparently spent months researching sword fighting, and all those references to certain defenses and styles were based on completely accurate 16th and 17th century techniques by legendary swordsmen. You can still purchase some of the fencing manuals written by them online. Books like The Academy of the Sword, 1630, by the Flemish master Gérard Thibault d'Anvers, or Great Representation of the Art and Use of Fencing, written by the Italian maestro Ridolfo Capoferro, and dating back to 1610, and even Treatise on the Science of Arms with philosophical dialogue by his fellow compatriot, the noted fencer, engineer, mathematician, and architect of the Renaissance, Camillo Agrippa, published in 1553. Back then, I knew who none of these people were, or indeed very much about sword fighting at all. I had confessed as much to both Rob and Andy early in the process. And I told them that even though I had taken some minor fencing lessons at acting school, it had been determined by my tutors that this was not something they thought I would ever be able to master. I wasn't just a novice, I was clueless.
"Don't worry," Rob insisted. "You'll be training with the best. It'll be fun."
Training with the best. It always sounds fun in conversation, but the practical reality is something quite different. More like, "Don't worry, you'll be training with the best Sherpa to help you climb Everest." Or, "Don't worry, you'll be training with the greatest human cannonball before we fire you out of the cannon." I'd long admired serious athletes, and I always tried to treat a challenge as an opportunity. And then I began to think, wait a minute, how hard could it really be? I'd seen plenty of Errol Flynn and Douglas Fairbanks movies. My developing inane theory was that if they could do it, so could I. It didn't seem that difficult. A few quick thrusts, some fancy footwork. More like dancing than combat. I could handle it, I thought. No problem. I was, of course, somewhat deluded. On the same day that I first visited the production offices at Shepperton Studios, I was told I would be contacted by one of the two gentlemen who would be in charge of the fight training and coordinating stunts for the film. Their names were Peter Diamond and Bob Anderson. It shames me somewhat to admit this now, but I'd never heard of either of these two men when I received the message that day. I reasoned correctly that Rob knew what he was doing and would only assign such an important task to seriously qualified people. That, as it turned out, was an understatement.
Rob Reiner. Because the sword fight is described as the greatest sword fight in movie history, I wanted to make good on that. I wanted it to be great, and I wanted Carrie and Mandy to be able to do it. I knew that in all the old Errol Flynn movies, Captain Blood and Robin Hood and stuff, he only did his sword fighting in the close-ups. For the wide shots, they would always get great stunt people to do it, a great swordsman. As a matter of fact, one of the swordsmen that we used, Bob Anderson, actually doubled for Flynn. He was an Olympic fencer, and he and Peter Diamond were the two guys who constructed the fencing sequence.
Peter Diamond was a good 3 decades into what is generally regarded as one of the most legendary careers of any stuntman or stunt coordinator in both television and film. As a sword trainer, he had worked with both Errol Flynn and Burt Lancaster. And in the previous decade alone, he had served as stunt coordinator on the original Star Wars trilogy. For you Wikipedians reading this, the Tusken Raider that surprises young Luke Skywalker on the Tatooine clifftop with that horrifying scream? That was Peter. He had also been the stunt arranger and coordinator on movies like From Russia with Love, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Highlander. Classically trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, Peter had also appeared in front of the camera, not only as a stuntman, but sometimes as an actor as well. That's him, as the German soldier Indy notices in his side mirror, climbing along the side of the 80-mile-an-hour speeding truck without a harness in Raiders. Peter logged in more than 1,000 credits before passing away in 2004, at the age of 75. He was vibrant and actively employed until the last year of his life. Bob Anderson was also a native of England, and also something of a national hero, having served in the Royal Marines during World War II, and as a representative of Great Britain on the fencing team in the 1952 Summer Olympics in Helsinki. He later became president of the British Academy of Fencing and a coach for the British national team. His expertise as a swordsman eventually took him to Hollywood, where he became a sought-after stuntman and a fight coordinator. The man's resume was breathtaking, from coaching Errol Flynn like Peter in the 1950s to choreographing fight scenes for several James Bond films in the 1960s, and working alongside Peter in From Russia with Love and Star Warrior Alert on the Star Wars trilogy. That is Bob using the dark side of the Force as Vader in all the lightsaber sequences.